very much satisfied that young, intelligent men and women, as yourselves, are taking a sincere interest in searching into the spiritual values of life. Because the age that you are now, is a time when you are at a most critical period of your life. It is a time when most human beings within this society, they decide their path of life for their destiny. You see, once we get into the world of career and professionalism, oftentimes we become so much entrapped, locked in our responsibilities of family, career, and so forth. It is very difficult for us to open our hearts and open our minds to alternative ways of thinking. Therefore, it has always been at the time when young men and women are in their high school and in their colleges, that they can be given the opportunity to question their own existence, to ask questions why and how. Even in the name of religion, we are often taught from our very birth to accept some principles in our life. Our parents, we see them doing some puja or reading some scripture, telling us, you must do this, you must not do this. But as we grow older, the natural inclination is to ask, why? And if we do not get sufficient answers, then what happens is our so-called religion simply remains a superficial ritual without any realization, without any spiritual enlightenment or insight. Shama eva hi kevalam. Perhaps such a religious outlook of life will make one a little more pious. But is the goal of life simply to be pious? The purpose of any spiritual system is to have direct experience and realization of a sublime existence beyond our present framework of the senses and the mind. So yes, this is a very important time of your life. And for young men and women to take the time to question their existence, to try to understand who is God, what is the goal of life, what is beyond birth and death, who am I, where am I coming from, why is there suffering and what is real pleasure? Why is there so much havoc throughout the world? And what can I do to immune myself as well as to be a part of the solution for the welfare of all humanity? This is the time of life when it is most urgent to ask these questions. We find in the Bhagavad Gita, it is a series of questions and answers. Arjuna, who was a very well-educated man, and he was a soldier by profession, he was put into a predicament of life which was so incomprehensible to him. It was so painful to even think of. He had to fight a war in which friends and relatives were on both sides. He did not know whether he should fight or not fight. He was on the threshold of a war where he could see nothing but pain and suffering coming from it. And therefore it created great distress in his mind. At that time he became very serious to inquire from his friend and his master, Lord Krishna. And the Bhagavad Gita is the series of questions and answers between the two. Similarly, the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is considered the ripened fruit of the Vedic literatures, is a series of questions and answers between Maharaj Parikshit and Shukadeva Goswami. Maharaj Parikshit was a king. It took a very difficult circumstance to bring him to the point of asking his questions. He was given the notice that he would die within in 7 days. He went to the bank of the Ganges to associate with saintly persons. And he chose that one saintly person who was most learned and most pure in heart, Shukadeva Goswami. And he asked him 3 questions. And these 3 questions are the most important questions in a human being's life. The Srimad Bhagavatam is 18,000 slokas or verses. And they are all a series of questions and answers between Maharaj Parikshit and Shukadeva Goswami, which are meant to illustrate a comprehensive understanding of the answer to these 3 questions. The first question that Maharaj Parikshit asked pertains to all of us. There are so many professions in this world. There are doctors and lawyers and engineers, accountants, housewives, farmers, businessmen, and so on. And everyone in this world is working very, very hard. Without work, we cannot survive. People are working for their nations. People are working for their families. What is the supreme occupation for all humanity? What is the most essential responsibility that every human being must accept in his life? That was the first question. The second question was that there are many religions in this world. And each religion has their own scripture and their own spiritual preceptors, whether they be a prophet or a messiah or a guru or an avatar, incarnation. And each religion has its own individual forms of ritual and worship. And each religion has its own unique and personal name of God, which they call upon. Of all spiritual paths in all great religions, what is the essence that underlies all of them? What is that essential goal which is consistent, common, and which must be attained through all religions? And the third question is the most pertinent and most significant and most urgent for each and every sincere human being to understand. That third question was, what is the duty of a person who is about to die? The greatest illusion in all of creation, as stated by Maharaj Yudhisthira in the Mahabharata, is that every living being sees people all around dying. Perhaps your grandparents, your great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, where are they? We read in the newspapers. We learn about friends and relatives. People are dying all around, but everyone is thinking, not me. It will not happen to me. But factually, death could come upon anyone at any moment. And the integrity of a human being is that you have a certain extent of time between the time you come out of your mother's womb to the time you must depart from this world, which may be today, may be tomorrow, but it will certainly be soon after. What will we accomplish between birth and death? You see, money, fame, prestige, physical relationships, none of these can survive beyond the passing of this body, what we call death. Therefore, the great prophet Muhammad he instructed us, die before you die. What does that mean? Until you die from the illusion that the temporary things of this world are all in all to life, you cannot enter into real life, into true life. When we speak of life, we can even, from a scientific platform of thinking, we can come to the conclusion that this material body is not really my life. It is a temporary shell. It is a vehicle. The body is always changing. The soul remains the same. It is that consciousness, that spiritual force, which is the source of life within us all. The distinction between the body and the source of life, the real self, the soul, is the beginning of real knowledge. And to understand the nature of that soul, or the consciousness and its relationship with God, is the supreme occupation of all humanity. And if we neglect this principle in our life, then we have cheated ourselves of the greatest wealth and the greatest attainment, the reservoir of all pleasure. I am coming from the Western world, where there are many very successful, wealthy persons. I see no greater happiness in the wealthy than the poor. I see no greater pleasure in the lives of the famous than the infamous, or those persons who appear insignificant. In fact, I see that the insatiable greed for more and more and more, the more you get, the more disturbed you become for more. And the more you disturb, you become to protect what you have. And this is a fact. It is a great illusion. We are chasing after these things. We are working day and night for that which will bring us no real happiness, only a superficial idea of happiness. But if you examine happiness with a rational and open mind, you will find that happiness is a state of your own heart. It's not a state that is created by your environment. Recently, I was in a courtroom. I had to be a witness, and I saw that the man who was being tried, he was completely peaceful, completely absorbed in the highest pleasure, feeling compassion and mercy toward all those around him, beaming with a radiant smile coming from the core of his heart. And there was another man who happened to be the prosecuting attorney. Probably worth several $1 million. Big, beautiful home, family, children, freedom to do what he wants, when he wants, freedom to forcibly have the power to put other innocent people or guilty people behind bars. This man was so agitated, so disturbed. His leg was shaking, he was chewing on his pencils. He couldn't look at anybody in the face. It was obvious that this man was utterly frustrated, suffering, miserable person. But he had everything in the world: power, money, freedom, but not a trace of real happiness. And here was this other man who ultimately was sent to prison for something he didn't even do. And he is radiating with joy. This is an extreme example. But who would you rather be? A success? Name in all the newspapers as being victorious? Gain millions of dollars and be miserable, or be sitting alone in a prison, humiliated to the world, in perfect equiposed happiness and peace? Huh? We do not necessarily have to go to that extreme, but we can understand that real happiness comes from within, never will come from without. There can be a sense of happiness coming from without, but it doesn't go any deeper than our senses. Real happiness is found within our heart, just as real love is found within our heart. And there is no greater happiness than the pleasure of loving and being loved. That is a fact. Money has never bought love, and it never will buy love, because it cannot buy love, neither of this world nor of the love of God. And the type of love that is bought by money is the type of love that usually fructifies in hate and anxiety, because it is not of the heart, it is of the mind. And the mind is flickering, chanchalam, unsteady. Therefore, the real pleasure we are all seeking is the pleasure of love, real love. And the purest, highest, the most natural love is the love that we all have and cherish for God. Whether you call him Allah or Christ or Ram or Krishna, that one supreme person who has infinite names is residing within the heart of every living being. And when we learn to find that God within our heart, and we learn to love that God within our heart, that is the supreme goal, the supreme destination, and the supreme occupation in all existence. Because that love can bring us real pleasure, real happiness, real joy. And of course, if you have nothing, you have nothing to give. When you attain that joy within your own heart and you share it with the world, then you are the true well-wisher and friend. That is the greatest charity you can give to another. The greatest charity is not in food or clothing. The greatest charity is in love. And if you have food, and if you have clothing, and if you have medical abilities, give those things, but with love. If you love, you'll naturally give whatever you can. But if you do not love, even charity, it's just another form of superficial thirst for prestige. Or some form of piety which has a selfish motivation. By giving, I will receive some benefits myself. That will not satisfy your heart. What will satisfy your heart is only one thing: the unconditional giving of love. And that unconditional giving of love is rooted in connecting with God's love. That is yoga. That is religion. Reconnecting our hearts with God's love. So, if we want a better world, technological advancement is not going to make this world better in and of itself. After all, New York City is very technologically advanced, Los Angeles, but yet due to frustration and anxiety, the youth of that generation are turning to horrible drugs, crimes, gang wars, alcoholism, horrible disease such as AIDS and cancer. These are all the products of a very sophisticated technological society. Why? Because there is a missing ingredient: truth. From truth is born love. the solution to the problems within our own life, within our family's life, and within our societies and within the world is there must be the establishment of truth. And from that truth, love. So now you are embarking upon a great career in your life. That is a wonderful thing. But the question that I beseech you to ask from the core of your own hearts, what will be the very foundation of my motivations through whatever field of occupation I dedicate my life? Will it be greed or will it be love? Arjuna was a warrior. By asking relevant questions, he became a warrior who fought, believe it or not, in a consciousness of pure love. He fought as an act of charity. He fought as an act of compassion, as an act of service to God and to all humanity. Krishna says in the Gita, Yat karoshi yadashnashi yad johoshi tatasi yat yatapashyasi kaunteya tat karushu madarakanam. That whatever you do, learn to do it as an offering to me. Whether you are studying to be engineers or doctors or lawyers or architects or farmers or scientists or computer technologists or housewives, whatever your field of study may be, do not omit, please do not neglect the very basis, the foundation, which will make all of your expressions through your learning meaningful, pleasurable, and beneficial to yourself and others. Do not neglect to inquire sincerely, who am I? What is the goal of life? How can I reconnect my consciousness with God's love from within? And how to express that love through everything I do? Some people think that if I become spiritually minded, I will not become efficient and able to cope with the competitiveness of this world. But this is not true. After all, which is a more powerful and a force in this world? Greed or love? To the extent you are doing your activities, performing your work in God's love, to that degree, you will be the most efficient, the most committed, the most dedicated. If you're simply doing it for money, you will have not one trillionth the initiative as if you are doing it as an act of service, as an act of love. Therefore, we should not be afraid to spiritualize our lives, especially at this time. Spiritual life is not something that you accept after a long, long life of just working and working and working. When I'm very old, there's nothing left to do. My body is becoming invalid. Now is the time to think about God. What about the rest of the world? When you come to that stage, you will not have the capacity to do anything. Now that you are young, strong, powerful, intelligent, go into this world armed with the sword of love. Let that sword cut the knot of ignorance from the hearts of those who are suffering. Coming to this temple, if any of you were to come tomorrow, we have a congregation of several hundred people that come. Some of the biggest industrialists in India. Big, big businessmen. Restaurant owners. Engineers. Some of the most successful doctors. They all come. They chant. They dance. They hear the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita. They worship God, not simply as a superficial show, not simply for some sense of superficial security, but they are worshiping God, and they are gaining day by day, moment by moment, realization and experience of that love of God in their hearts. And they are going out 6 days a week, raising their families and performing their work in such a way that they're actually really offering great benefits to society through whatever they do, because they are doing it in the spirit of devotion. The future of the world lies in your hands, no one else's. You have to take this principle seriously, that the young generation and the colleges today are holding the future of the world. This country of India is in your hands, its future. You will be the future leaders in every field, business, politics, everything. What influence do you want this great land? To be given. You can only influence to the extent you are willing to be influenced. If you are influenced by love, you can make a great change in this country and in the world through whatever you do. Therefore, the great need, not just to accept blindly, but to use our God-given rational intelligence to deeply probe and to question what will be my purpose of life. Whatever career you may choose, that is something else, but what is your purpose of life? Whatever you do, the question is, why will you do it? And then deeper and deeper you ask this question, why, the closer you come to God, naturally. So this is my very, very sincere and earnest request to all of you, is keep this fire of inquisitiveness alive within your hearts. Sincerely search and seek to understand the higher principles of philosophy, the higher principles of life. So at this time, if any of you have any sincere inquiries, I will try to answer your questions. Thank you very much.
Can you ask us when we go to their rooms, because they are studying engineering at least most of the students here are either engineering or in medicine. So they have very rigorous schedules. So they said that to what extent we should, how much time we should set aside for probably doing, saying prayers, and because we are already burdened with studies. And some of us can't find the time to come to temples. Maybe we can try and do something. Can you tell us what we could do?
We must establish our priorities in life. If you understand the necessity of something, you make time. There is plenty time if you understand the need. There's a famous saying in the English language that if you want to get something done, you ask a busy man. You don't ask a man who's doing nothing. Because if you ask a busy man to get something done, he'll make time to do it. But if you ask a man who's not doing anything to get something done, he won't have time. It's based on your desire. If you understand the need and the urgency for self-realization in your life, then whatever you are doing, you will make time. And I guarantee you, if you make that time, you will do better in whatever you do. Because the quality in which you do it will be much higher. The purpose of self-realization is to purify your mind. Now, do you not think that you could do much better whatever you're doing if you have a purified mind? If you are free from so much lust and anger and envy and greed and pride and illusion, do you not think your mind will be able to do in 1 hour what it ordinarily would take several hours to do? Of course. When we speak of time, are you going to live a quantity or are you going to live for quality? In regard to your studies, do you want quantity or quality? The deeper you go into your own consciousness through the science of self-realization, the more whatever you do will be of a higher quality on every level. Just like our Satchidananda, he's a businessman. What is the firm that you work for? Sandoz. Now there are so many people in his company. Every morning, he is doing prayers for several hours. How many hours? At least 1 hour. And evenings? At least 1 hour. It's not so much. 1 hour morning, 1 hour evening. He also has a family. He has a wife. He also has a mother and father. He's living with them. He has great responsibilities. He has 1 hour morning, 1 hour evening, and he's here today. He comes to our temple at least 3-4 times a week to help with different functions. Comes every Sunday. Comes every Friday. For not 1 hour, but 3-4 hours. Now, nobody else working for him is doing these things. They're all just working, 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 trying to get as much quantity of hours behind them as possible. Last year, the most distinguished award in this whole national company, who gained that award? He got the reward. for the greatest contribution to the entire corporation, of which how many people are in this corporation? 3,000 people. Out of 3,000 people working like asses, he got the award for contributing the best, for doing the best service, for being the most efficient in business, and he's the only one that happens to spend hours a day in his worship. Why is that? Because of the quality in which he is doing, with love, with compassion. Therefore, his determination, his dedication, everything is superior. What you are saying, that if you, how will we have time for self-realization if we have so many things to do? This is called penny wise and pounds foolish. To save a few pennies, you're losing many, many pounds. Or in India, it would be paisa wise and rupee foolish. If you understand the necessity of God realization in your life, then without a doubt you will make time. And you will not be the loser. You will gain many fold on all levels. You are all students, you're working hard. Do you have time to eat? No matter what you're doing, you have time to eat because you know the necessity of eating. Right? Do you have time to sleep? No matter how much you're busy, you sleep. Because you understand the necessity of sleep. If you understand that for the purification of my heart and for progressing toward the real goal of life, if meditation, chanting the name of God, and accepting certain disciplines for our purification, if we understand their necessity, they're more important than eating or sleeping. You'll do it no matter what. You'll make time. But first, your intelligence must be convinced of its importance. There is time. Where there is a will, there is a way. The most important part of your life is to cultivate that will. And then you will find a way. Is there any other questions? Being a Swami is not putting on a saffron robe. Being a Swami is a certain dedication, a certain commitment, and a certain principle that is one lives by. Swami means one who dedicates body, mind, words, and life in the service of God, putting all other things aside, and trying with all earnestness to present these principles to the rest of society. Now, this is a very important occupation within this society for a certain class of men and women to accept. Would you agree? So, in every walk of life, there is a certain uniform. That uniform has two purposes. One is it's practical in the execution of our duties, and two is it denotes to the rest of society what we're there for, so that they can take best advantage of our services. Correct? A policeman is a policeman whether he has his uniform on or not. Correct? But is there a value in the policeman wearing a uniform? If a policeman looks like everyone else and dresses like everyone else, if you need a policeman, you'll never find him. Right? So therefore, it's very important that he wears that particular uniform so that people could identify with him and take advantage of what he has to offer. Similarly, in a policeman's uniform, he's equipped with his gun, his cane, whatever. So therefore, it's very, very practical for him to do his job with the different aspects of his uniform. Another thing is this. It helps that policeman remain law-abiding. Because if a policeman is seen in his uniform doing something foolish or frivolous, everyone's going to immediately say, what kind of a nonsense policeman? Because if a policeman is seen in his uniform doing something foolish or frivolous, everyone's going to immediately say, what kind of a nonsense policeman are you? Huh? So by wearing his uniform, he's forced to act according to his role. So in this sense, it helps him do his service. It helps him to keep his mind fixed on his service, and it also helps others to understand who he is. Same with a doctor. A doctor is a doctor no matter how he dresses, but in a hospital, he wears a mask and he wears a hat and he wears all sorts of like robes. And so does a nurse. Why does a nurse wear white robes? One is because white is clean. And she has to be in the highest position of sanitation. And because it's so white, if there's any dirt, she knows that I can't wear this. It's not clean. So it helps her in her service. And also, if anyone is suffering and they need a nurse, they can identify with her immediately. Huh? So therefore, we find that those persons who are spiritual directors, in every religion, they have a certain uniform. In the Catholic tradition, there's a priest who wears black and a collar, perhaps, and the nuns who sometimes wear a veil. In India, the swamis, who are spiritual directors, who are meant to be spiritual leaders for society, helping to give spiritual guidance to humanity, they wear the saffron color so that you can identify, here is a person. If I have any questions about God or about the goal of life, I can ask him. I know where he is. And even if I have nothing to ask him, just by seeing him walk down the street, I remember that, yes, God is the goal of life. We should remember that when we see the saffron color. Just like when you're driving and you see a policeman, you think, oh, I better stay in my lane. Right? If you don't see the policeman from time to time, you may forget. So when you see the Swami, you think, oh, maybe I should chant the holy names of God. So for this reason, the color is very useful. It is the uniform. Of course, originally the color saffron comes from people, there are many stories, but many years ago, Swamis would often, after taking this vow, they would go to the forest, they would meditate. And in the forest, there are many wild animals, snakes. And when they're sitting in meditation with eyes closed, they are not aware of what is around them. So the animals are afraid of fire. So the saffron color is a color that reminds these creatures of fire. And therefore, even while sitting with their eyes closed or sleeping at night, they would be less threatened by such creatures of the jungle. But then when such persons came out to spread the glories of a spiritual lifestyle to humanity, the color became like the uniform in which they accept. And it's also very simple. For instance, for us to wash our clothes, these two pieces of cloth I wear, it takes about 1.5 minutes to wash and about a half hour to dry, anywhere, everywhere. So it's very simple. And also, we go beyond fashion consciousness. People are very much thinking about the latest fashions, which is very much puts our mind on our bodies. Huh? We want to give our bodies the best it needs, but no more. Give it nutritious food, keep it very clean. But for a Swami, he wants to just minimize his bodily consciousness as far as possible. So Swamis have worn the same style and the same color for the last so many thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So we never think when we wake up, what should I wear today? Is there any other questions? Oh. There were three questions on this saffron paper. Why do Swamis shave off their hair? Some Swamis leave their hair to grow and they never comb it. Huh? Some Swamis... There are many different hairstyles for Swamis. But the principle of all of them is simplicity. Those who just let their hair grow and never comb it, matted locks, their conviction is that they just forget the needs of their body beyond keeping it clean and keeping it healthy. Huh? They're not trying to look beautiful with their hair. They just let their hair naturally grow and do whatever it wants to do. Huh? That is a symbol of renunciation. They're symbolizing to the society through their growing of matted hair a sense of renunciation. They're no longer trying to look beautiful. And shaving the head is the same principle. But also, it's very clean. Cleanliness is next to godliness. One time they asked our spiritual master, "Why do you shave your head?" And he said, "Because it's very clean." Cleanliness is next to godliness. And one time another person said, "Why do you shave your head?" And he said, "Because it takes a cool head to understand God." And another time, one very aggressive woman reporter for American newspaper said, "Why do you shave your head?" And Prabhupada looked at her and said, "Why do you shave your legs?" And she said, she didn't know what to say. And he said, "Better to have a cool head than cold legs." Next question. To worship God, is it necessary to go to the temple only? Is physical presence more important than mental chanting of the Supreme? Very good question. To worship God, is it necessary to go to the temple only? We go to the temple for inspiration. We go to the temple to associate with the holy people that are living at the temple. You see, today in India, one of the great problems is there are so many temples with the form of God. And there are so many priests who give little charanamrit, little water, and who ask for a donation. This is nice, but it is not enough. Originally, the purpose of a temple was, yes, the form of God is there, but those persons who are in the temple, it is their duty to educate you on how to see the form of God in the temple, how to serve the form of God in the temple, and how to live your life when you go home from the temple in such a way that you never have, that the form of God will never leave your heart. The temple is meant to be a spiritual, educational campus. Huh? It is not meant to simply come and go. It is like a college where you should go to learn, to be purified. It is a place where you should hear the philosophy of life. And you should meet other people there who are like-minded. And through your unity together, you can inspire one another. A place where you can meet people and make friends with people who are spiritually minded. And then when we leave the temple and we go to our homes, we are spiritually surcharged with a direction in our life which will always keep our connection to God in whatever we do. Is physical presence more important than mentally chanting of the Supreme? You see, they are both all important. The chanting of the holy name of the Lord is most essential because that pure sound vibration can always keep our consciousness in unity with God. And through that unity, love will naturally grow, inevitably. But for us to have the conviction to chant the holy name of the Lord in the proper state of mind, in the proper consciousness, with the proper attitude of service, we come to the temple to associate with like-minded persons exclusively for rejuvenating our spiritual consciousness. The real glory of a temple is when people come to that temple to come together before God to rejuvenate each other's spiritual consciousness and take that enlightened state back to wherever we go in our life. Huh? Therefore, both things are most important. Factually, your heart is a temple. Whether you are at home, whether you are in the jungle, whether you are in the city streets of Bombay, your heart is meant to be a temple where you are always remembering and serving the Lord. Huh? But it's so easy to forget that our heart is a temple. Therefore, we come to the physically manifest temple to get that very needed spiritual reminder. Therefore, it is said by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that the two most important things in our spiritual development is the two things that you are asking about in your question. It's a wonderful question. One is to regularly and sincerely chant the God's name, the name of Krishna, or the name of the Lord. and two is to associate with saintly persons. It is said in the Srimad Bhagavatam, one who goes to a holy place just to take a bath is cheating himself of the real glory of the holy place. The real glory of the holy place is to associate with the holy persons that are living there. Huh? So similarly, the real glory of coming to a temple is to associate with the holy persons that can inspire us to love God. Is there any other questions?
We read that we are not body, but we are spirit soul. So how to realize it principally?
This is a very vital question. Because theoretical knowledge without realization has very little value. The purpose of everything we're speaking today is that all of us gain direct experience of these truths. To simply intellectually understand them is necessary so that we do what is required for the realization. Just like if you are sick, and you are given an intelligent understanding by a medical practitioner of exactly what your disease is and exactly what the medicine is required to cure your disease. Is that intellectual understanding necessary? If it is not, you will not know why you're suffering and you will not know the way out. But is it enough to just know it? You have to go to the pharmacy, you have to get the medicine, you have to purchase it, and you have to take it. If you do not take it, there will be no value to all of your intellectualization of what it is I have to take or why. When you take it, then the effects of cure and good health take place. Correct? So similarly, first we must intellectually know that we are not this body, we are the eternal soul. But that is not enough. We have to put this into practice. How? As I explained at the beginning, we must have a sincere inquiry. We must sincerely desire to know. We must hear. And then we must put into our life the principles by which we can gain that realization. And the simplest method is to chant the holy name of God, to regularly associate with persons who are on that path, to develop intimate friendships with such persons. Because in this society, we need that support. We need that reminder. And to also give up those materialistically sinful activities that inhibit our advancement. Such activities as illicit sex outside of marriage, intoxication, which infatuates the illusions of this great ignorance that is upon us, gambling and unnecessary violence to others caused by meat eating. When we live according to these four codes, we regularly chant the pure name of God, which awakens this natural divinity within us, and we associate regularly with holy persons who can give us guidance and encouragement, you simply do these three simple principles, you will gradually experience the realization of the eternal soul beyond this body. And it is practical. And anyone can do it if they simply understand the importance. Is there any other questions? Yes.
The most prevalent philosophy we see in colleges and even in the work environment is that work is worship, and people will go to the extent of even quoting Bhagavad Gita saying that Krishna is prescribing karma yoga for that. And they say if you are doing your work well, you are trying to maintain your family well, that is good enough. That is what worship is all about. So how do you counter this?
Where does it say that in Bhagavad Gita?
People quote Bhagavad Gita to say that karma yoga is the prescribed path. Karma nevadika.
Everyone likes to quote according to what they want to hear. But what is the verse? Karma nyevadikarshasthi mapaleshu takashtana makarma palahiturpu mate sangostu karma. This does not mean that. It means work is worship, but what kind of work is worship? Not just any kind of work. You have a right to perform your duty, but you are not entitled to the fruits of your action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities, and never be attached to not doing your duty. So when they say work is worship, they just want to take the last line of the four lines. Never be attached to not doing your duty. Right? The conclusion of Bhagavad Gita is never be attached to not doing your duty. That's 1/4 of one sloka out of over 700. And they completely neglect all the other 699 3/4. And they come up with this philosophy that work is worship. Huh? Krishna says in the third chapter, Jagyaratat kamanon yatra loko mam karma bandana karma kontes mamupeta sukontya. Jagya karma. That work done as sacrifice for Vishnu, for God, has to be performed. Any other work you do for any other reason is only a cause of karma bandhana, which means bondage. And I already quoted, yat karoshi yat asnashi yat johoshi dudasi yat. All that you do, that means all work that you do should be done as an offering to me. Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha ishami masucha. Abandon all varieties of religion, just surrender to me. Bhagavad Gita teaches one thing throughout: to surrender to God, to work for God. Work is worship when it is done as an offering of love and devotion to God. If it is done for any other purpose, that work is not worship. That work is a manifestation of greed. Bhagavad Gita teaches surrender. Surrender is a sweet concept. It means giving up all of our false motivations and simply offering everything as an expression of love to him. That is Bhagavad Gita. After all, was Duryodhana doing? They were both working. From this work as worship point of view, Duryodhana was as good as Arjuna. They were both doing their duty. The only difference is Arjuna was doing his duty for the pleasure of Krishna, and Duryodhana was doing his duty for the sake of his own personal ambitions. That is the difference. Bhagavad Gita teaches work as done as a sacrifice for Vishnu must be performed. Every other type of work you do will be a cause of bondage. Any other questions? Yes.
Sir, actually I have two questions. One is about non-meat eating and all that. So what do the other religions have to say about this? Because I think the Christians and the Mohammedans, they do eat, and perhaps they have religious sanction. I'm not sure. But if so, then why? And the second question is about non-intoxication, non-meat eating and not gambling. So there are plenty of people who don't indulge in any of this, but they don't seem to be any more self-realized than the next person. So there's something more needed again. So what is that?
Thank you very much. In every religion, there is a strong forbiddance, forbidding of eating meat. But there is also sanction for those who are so inclined to do it under certain restrictive conditions. And according to the particular place and time where a religious scripture is revealed, there's more emphasis on one than the other. In the Old Testament, it is explained in the Garden of Eden, in Genesis, that the fruit of the tree should be your meat. That is how God has instructed Adam and Eve. And there's absolutely not a mention of any meat eating until after the flood of Noah's Ark. In fact, in the Bible it says that in the spiritual world, the man, the lion, the lamb, they will all live together side by side as friends. They will love one another. That's the describing of the kingdom of God. And the kingdom of God is meant to be established here on earth. That means we're all living beings, are no longer exploiting one another, killing each other, but they're loving one another. Huh? After the flood, it is said, because of your hardness of heart, God said, I give you these laws. And then there are chapters and chapters and chapters of pages in the Old Testament which explain the type of sacrifice that should be performed if you want to eat meat. They're all very restrictive. It's called the kosher way, that you have to kill the animal in such a way. If you don't do it, that's better. But if you're going to do it anyway, do it like this. Bring it before the altar. A certain type of priest should kill the animal in such a way that the blood doesn't flow in a certain way and that there's minimum amount of pain. Sacrifice. And that sacrifice should be offered to God. It's not just done whimsically, unconsciously. It's not that nowhere in the Quran, nowhere in the Old Testament, nowhere in the New Testament, nowhere in the Vedas do you go to the restaurant and buy meat. Or go to the grocery to buy meat. You have to make a holy sacrifice to God. And that's only because you're already not willing to give it up. In the Vedas also, in the Markandeya Purana, it is described, if you want to eat meat, you take a goat. On the dark moon night, and you bring it before the goddess Kali. And then you can kill it. But before you kill it, you whisper in its ear. There's a certain mantra. Because I'm killing you now, next birth, you have the right to come and kill me. Then you can eat. If you do it any other way, it's not sanctioned. It's sinful. If you do it that way, it's sanctioned. So the various scriptures of the world give sanction to eat meat for those who are going to do it under restrictive conditions. But sanction does not mean that that is what God wants. It doesn't mean that that's the highest. Ultimately, we should put aside these sanctions which are meant to just give us a chance to dovetail or to engage our own propensities and come to what God wants, which is to be merciful and to be compassionate and to be loving to all creatures. Doesn't that make sense? Is there any other? What was the second part of your question? Because you see, these four principles, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, no meat eating, are not in and of themselves spiritual. They are simply moral. Moral is sattva-guna. Sattva-guna means the mode of goodness. See, there are three gunas. Tamaguna, Rajaguna, Sattvaguna. The mode of ignorance. Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that that everything we do can be categorized as either the mode of goodness, passion, or ignorance. People who are laziness, intoxication, eating rotted corpses, these things are considered the mode of ignorance. Just a huge passion for money, for fame, for sex. These things are in the mode of passion. To do good to others, to eat very pure, fresh foods, to listen to nice poetry, to do good, to be good, this is sattva-guna. This is the mode of goodness. From the mode of goodness, we can rise ourselves to the spiritual platform. But if you just stay in the mode of goodness, you're not going to become spiritually advanced. So these four regulative principles is just to put our lifestyle in a lifestyle of morality and goodness, which is still material. But from that springboard of morality and goodness, when we chant the name of God, when we perform our puja, when we perform our work in devotion to God, then we can very quickly and rapidly advance spiritually and come closer to God. But if we are not in the mode of goodness and we perform our spiritual worship, it's like the elephant that bathes in the water, then comes out and throws the dirt all over himself again. You're becoming purified, and then you just throw all karma bandhana, binding karma, all over your consciousness again. Other questions? Yes.
Recently there was a huge cyclone in Bangladesh, you must have heard, and lakhs of people were killed. So the question is, does God have any control over such disasters, and can bhakti prevent such disasters?
Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha. God has complete control over everything. He is the supreme controller. But in His divine control, out of His mercy, He has created this material nature so that there is the law of action and reaction. He has created it out of He has created it by His control. But He also gives us the independence where it is within our control whether we suffer or find happiness. Now Krishna speaks the scriptures to tell us how to find real happiness. That is his control, is He gives us the choice whether we're going to accept it or reject it. If we reject His instructions and act sinfully, then we have to suffer. So yes, that suffering is under His control. But why is He allowing us to suffer? To teach us a lesson. Just like a very simple example, one time our Guru said that he had a friend who had a son who said, "Father, I want to touch this fire." And the father said, "No, do not touch the fire." The father said, "No, I really want to touch the fire." And the father said, "No, do not touch the fire." The son said, "But I want to touch the fire." So the father said, "You should not touch your fire. You will suffer if you do, but do what you want." So the child touched the fire. The next day, the father said, "So, do you want to touch the fire?" He said, no, I will never touch the fire again." So sometimes we have to suffer to learn. That is under God's control. That is His mercy, that He allows us to learn. He gives us the easiest way by hearing, but if we're not willing to listen, experience is the best teacher, and a fool learns by no other way. An intelligent person learns by hearing. A foolish person has to go through experience of suffering. And a more foolish person, after suffering again and again and again, birth after birth after birth, goes on. So these material, there are threefold miseries. There is the misery caused by one's own body and mind, adiatmaka. Adibhotika is the miseries caused by natural disturbances, such as cyclones, too much heat, too much cold. There is also Adi Daivaka. And Adi Bhautaka means miseries caused by other living beings. So they are all under the control of the Lord.